minutes here. Let me just say, is it not correct? Am I not correct in saying that most of what we're going to talk about here this weekend has something to do with how we communicate, how we communicate with people? And if we have trouble communicating, it's going to hinder what we're doing. If we're better at communicating, it'll probably help us. How do you define, what does it mean to communicate something? Has anybody studied communication theory here in this room? And I think I'm correct in saying communication occurs when you have one idea that you can get that idea from your mind to the mind of somebody else intact. Is that pretty much to take care of communication? That's good enough for me anyway. And so, of course, we have all kinds of ways of trying to make sure we've done that. Sometimes we'll say something to somebody and then we want to make sure they've got it. We'll say, now, did you get that? And they'll say, yeah. Which means what? Means no. What it usually means is they got what they think you said. So if we're not sure they still got what I really said, could you maybe say it back to me? But then they say it back to you, okay, now we got it. Well, you don't want to be doing that every time, do you? You're not going to have many friends left who want to communicate with you if you've got to go through that kind of process every time. And there's all kinds of things that can make communication go wrong. You have problems with that. I did hear of one. Yeah, what I was thinking is, sometime in our communication, we are our own worst enemies. We say things we probably shouldn't have said. Has anybody here ever got themselves into trouble by saying something? Is the moment you said it, you wish you wouldn't have said it. And then but it's been said now. So then you try to get yourself out of it. And the more you try to get out of it, the deeper you dig yourself. Has anybody had that experience, or am I the only one? Okay? It happens, doesn't it? I heard about this one, and sometimes you have to think fast and figure things out there. Well, I did hear about one young fellow who joined up for the military. And he was the kind of guy, he would sometimes think, and then, speak, and then think later. He spoke a little too fast. He signed up for the military, and he had just gotten in there, and it just started, and there was a great big gala, a great big ball. Everybody came. The privates and all the way up to the generals, they were all there. The whole big, massive auditorium full of people. People were standing around and talking and visiting, and then there was various speakers coming to the front. At one time, at the end of the evening, the general, the top guy, walked up to the front, and he began to speak. And this young military, this young soldier, looked around. He found it quite boring. There was a lady standing beside him. He turned to the lady and said, "Can you believe this old bore?" There was a pause. And she looks at him and says, "Young man, do you know who that man speaking is? And do you know who I am?" He says, "Well, no, I don't, ma'am." And she says, "I'm the wife of that man you just called an old bore." And he realized he was in a lot of trouble. And he thought fast. He said, "Well, lady, do you know who I am?" And she said, "No, I don't." "Thank God," he said, as he took off for the door. So that's how he got himself out of that one. Now, once in a while, you can get yourself out of things by doing that kind of thing. But usually it takes a little more than that to get out of it once you get yourself into something. And so we're hoping that over as the weekend goes, there's a couple things that will happen here. We'll begin to develop ideas and truth and information we can work with, so we can have information that we can actually use. Because apologetics, everything we're doing here, really is of not much value to us unless we're able to work with it and concentrate on it and really digest it to the degree where we can actually use it. If we can't use it in conversation, then there's not a real whole lot of value in us doing what we're doing. So we really want to be able to come to that point where we can use our ideas. You know, the first question I've got for you is this. We're going to be dealing with this one and then the question of tolerance a little bit later on. And my first question I've got for you is, and I'd like for you to talk to people around you on this one for just a moment. Why is this such a big deal? This question, isn't morality relative? Why are we going to take the next 45 minutes or so and talk about this question? Moral relativism versus moral absolutism or moral objectivism. Why is this important? Is moral relativism an important issue for us to think about? Is it an obstacle? Is it an obstacle to people believing, embracing Christ? Or is it some other kind of obstacle? Is it a problem? What makes it, if it's a problem, why is it a problem? Why the big deal? Can I just have you talk to people around you for just a moment and think about that? Is this an important issue? What makes it important? 3-4 minutes, and then let's hear a couple of you responding back, and then we'll go from there. Thanks. Thank you. Attention, please, here. I wouldn't mind hearing back from a few of you on this. What is the big issue with here? And just tell us a few things that some of you have said in your groups here. What's the big issue? Why is this an important matter? What makes it important? Anything that was said in the group. Just raise your hand, a couple of you. Again. Yes, sir. Say that again.
It's actually a matter of truth or false.
It's a matter of truth. Okay. Okay, so it's a matter of truth and falsehood, and it's one of very foundational forms, okay? And true, you're saying truth matters. Okay, very good. How about back here? I saw another hand, I thought. Oh, you're holding your hand up for one of those, okay. Dude, this is like an auction sale. Once you put your hand up, you bought it, okay? And anybody else here?
What is morality?
Well, that's right. This gets at the very foundational question, what morality really is. If you answer this way, yes or no, you have a whole different set of a view of what morality really is. It's very foundational that way. Terry, what were you going to say?
We were just talking about cultural differences.
Yeah.
In Canada, North America, it's like one husband, one wife, considered normal and acceptable.
Uh-huh.
In many countries, you have one man and many wives in that
country. Right.
Right.
And he says, so you say there's no way to settle some of this stuff. Okay. Keep that very example there, that very kind of question in mind here as we go through. Because some people, there's going to be a certain element in our culture who are very happy to say, yes, it is all relative. Okay. Let's see what happens when we try to play that out consistently as we go here a little bit later on. So that's good. I thought I saw another hand back just behind. Yes. Okay. Which question? This one right here?
Isn't morality relative? They're saying morality is relative, so this is my truth.
Okay. Yeah. Well, you mean in the very way you ask the question? Well, sure. So, I mean, when you think of it, when you frame a question a certain way, you're leaning toward a certain answer almost always, aren't you? So that's that, yeah. And it does lead toward a certain answer. No doubt about it. Yeah. Yes, way up here, yeah.
Without an objective reality, you can change your morality to whatever.
Okay. Okay. So there's a lot. Let's put it this way: a lot more flexibility. You can make changes a lot more easily. There's no doubt about it. And we need to talk about why that is as we go here. But that what you say is true. Did I see one other hand here somewhere? Yes. Yes, sir.
The viewpoint of yours is not necessarily the viewpoint of others.
Okay. You mean what are you saying? If morality is relative. Because actually, that might actually be the case either way. You may believe an objective moral truth and somebody else may, but you may take different points of view on it, but you still may actually both believe there is a real objectively right answer, one or the other, and you may disagree on it. But I will tell you this. When you think about moral disagreement, that's a term that philosophers use, moral disagreement. Moral disagreement really, and I'm not sure if you were getting at this point, but it's worth raising it. Moral disagreement, genuine moral disagreement is only really even possible. And I think you can see why. If morality is objective. Right? Because then you could actually have a different point of view on what the right or the wrong is. If morality is all relative, then moral disagreement becomes impossible. And so certain philosophers who argue this will say, do you think there's any such thing as real moral disagreement? And if you do, then you are already admitting, even though you didn't know you were, you're actually conceding that there is such a thing as real objective moral value. So that's one of those interesting things to think about. Moral disagreement. Yeah, and then differently, how about moral progress? Is there such a thing as real moral progress? Could that be? Or moral regress, the other way. If either of those things are possible, you know what it means? morality is others, and objectivity to morality. We're going a little bit further than just the questions here, though. Yes, right over here. Yeah.
Those are generally absolute.
Yeah.
Like, you know, murder is murder, but then there's,
Yeah.
So there has to be some agreement that this is wrong.
Yeah. You would have trouble getting the laws of the land. You probably would if there wasn't some kind of agreement on this, wouldn't you? Here's the thing to keep in mind, though. There is a distinction, and it's a distinction you make anytime I ever teach at the class called Ethics Course Ethics, which is what I do teach. I make this distinction pretty much in the first day, a distinction between law and morality. The two are not exactly the same thing. And the reason we say that is, you can see that is because you can talk about a law being a good law, a morally good law, or a bad law, an immoral law. You can talk about that. As soon as you do that, you recognize that there's something different going on between law and morality. And in fact, when certain people are involved in what's called civil disobedience, that's what they're often doing. They're trying to bring to the attention of their entire society that a certain law is unjust. It's out of sync with morality, okay? So you still could get laws which are completely immoral. They can be enforced if the government is able to do it. You could get that. But I tell you, you're living in a pretty serious situation if that's happening. See, really good comments, folks. Excellent. Let me read you something that got out of the newspaper just a short time back, written by a person who had just retired from being a district or a school principal, I should say, in the Lower Mainland. He wasn't a principal. He was actually the superintendent of schools for an entire district, is what he was. And here's what he wrote. Each night, as our family watches the evening news, I sense a tide of moral ambiguity flooding across my 16-year-old son's intelligence, sweeping the last vestiges of his innocence before it. He has questions, both thoughtful and thought-provoking, about wars, violence, disease, politics, and the media's take on it all. Now, I'll skip a little bit as we go here, but he says this. He's asking questions because such things trouble him as he tries to develop his own ethical and moral fix on life and how he should navigate himself in this information-rich sea of contradictions. Then he goes on to say, we talk about all this stuff in our home and how to decide what feels right and what does not, as if there is some conscientious compass built into every human spirit, which, if trusted, will point to somewhere between the true north of ethical behavior and the magnetic north of free will. Okay? But it's not enough. I know. He'll need some way when the time comes, and it will likely come when I'm not around. He'll need some way to resolve his own dilemmas and guide his own behavior. He says, most kids want to learn how to face issues and make their own rational decisions. Some never do, and the quality of their lives is proscribed accordingly. Then he ends by saying this, but many kids are left with the major questions unanswered. Is there such a thing as right and wrong? Can both sides of an issue be right or wrong? How do you distinguish? To find out, in the absence of any other properly structured experience, they turn back to the classroom of last resort and ethical ambiguity and just watch television. And that's what he writes. And to that, I just wrote right on the article, good luck, if that's what you're hoping for. I came across this other article a little bit ago by a Christian philosophy professor in the United States. And she writes this, and I'll just read part of what she wrote. Some time ago, she wrote this article. Some time ago, she says, I published an article entitled Ethics Without Virtue. Okay? In which I criticized the way ethics is being taught in American colleges. I pointed out that students taking college ethics classes debate issues like abortion, euthanasia, capital punishment, DNA research, the ethics of transplant surgery, and things like that, while they learn almost nothing about private decency, honesty, personal responsibility, or honor. So the personal stuff. She says, I argued that the current style of teaching ethics, which concentrates so much on social policy, is giving students the wrong ideas about ethics. Social morality is only half of the moral life, she said. The other half is private morality. And I urged that we attend to both. That's what she wrote in her article. Well, she says, a colleague of mine did not like what I said. She told me that in her classroom she would continue to focus on issues of social injustice, women's oppression, corruption in big business, transgressions of multinational corporations in third world countries. She explained, you are not going to have moral people until you have moral institutions. You will not have moral citizens until you have a moral government. Then she said, she made it clear that I was wasting time and even doing harm by promoting bourgeois virtues and not awakening the social conscience of my students. So that's what a colleague told hers. Well, at the end of the semester, she came into my office carrying a stack of exams and looking very upset. "What's wrong?" I asked. "They cheated," she said. "They cheated on their social justice take-home finals. They plagiarized. More than half of the students in her ethics class had copied long passages from the secondary literature." "Well, what are you going to do?" I asked. She gave me a self-mocking smile and said, "I'd like to borrow a copy of that article you wrote on ethics without virtue." And then she goes on to say, "Cheating has plagued many of our best universities. A recent survey reported in the Boston Globe said 50% of all college students admit to cheating. For high school students, the figure is about 75%. A U.S. News and World Report survey asked college-age students if they would steal from an employer. 34% said they would. And then she goes on with, I'll just read this one little statement and I'll end here. She says, many people come to college. And see, that's interesting to me. They didn't get this at university. They got this from the culture before they got to college. Many people come to college dogmatically committed to a moral relativism that offers them no grounds to think that cheating is simply wrong. It's just wrong on its own. No grounds to think that anymore. What about this question here, where we're saying, is morality relevant? I ask you, what's the big deal about this? You know how CSI asks this, because there's a pretty powerful point that I didn't even used to have in mind myself. I read this from C.S. Lewis probably about 10 years ago, and I thought I had read a lot of Lewis, and I knew Lewis pretty well. And then one day I came across something I'd never seen before. And he made this statement. He said, he talked about what he believed to be the greatest enemy of Christianity, the greatest obstacle, the greatest enemy, the worst thing for Christianity. And I thought he'd say something like atheism or whatever. You know what he said it is? Moral relativism. The strongest enemy, the worst enemy of Christianity. And I'm thinking, well, I know it's not really a good thing, but why is it the worst enemy? Well, some of you can probably think this, or maybe some of you already thought about this. It actually makes sense. He says, if moral relativism is true, and we're going to see why in just a moment here, if moral relativism is true, and there's nothing that's really objectively, genuinely wrong, it all just becomes a matter of your preference and my preference, it's relative to your opinion and my opinion, then what happens to the concept of sin? Real, genuine, objective sin. It's undermined, is it not? And then what happens to the need for grace? And what happens to the need for a Savior? It's all undermined. There's no need for grace. There's no need for a Savior. There's no need for Jesus. And I was thinking this morning, remember in what we said this morning, C.S. Lewis had already mentioned, and this picks up with what he said before, there's two foundational truths people must see, otherwise Christianity has nothing to say to them. And the one is, there is a real moral law there, coming from a moral lawgiver. And number two, none of us live up to it. Well, moral relativism undercuts that first one. If it's undercut, no need for a Savior, no need for Jesus, there's no need for the Christian gospel, the whole thing comes crashing down. And so that's why Lewis said, the number one enemy is moral relativism. Other things may be problems, but this one completely undercuts Christianity, moral relativism. So if we think it's fairly fashionable and that's just the way our society happens to be, it's really not a big deal. Lewis is saying, you've got a whole bunch of people set up to sense absolutely no need for what Jesus has done on that cross, because anything that's really wrong is simply a fluctuation, it changes, it's a matter of opinion. You know what, having said, keep that in mind, let's go to a few things in the notes here with all that in background. Let's get some definitions on the table. What do we mean by a moral relativism? Here's a basic definition. I think you have it in your notes already. But moral relativism, to put this in a nutshell, is simply the view that says there are no objectively true moral values which apply across the board to all people in a consistent way. There are no objectively true moral values which apply to all people consistently. Okay? You see what I'm saying there? Now, of course, what's the real key word in that definition? The word objective, isn't it? We need to know what that word means here. Well, sometimes I found the best way to define a word is by looking at its opposite. Of course, the opposite of objective is Subjective. So let's look at what that means. What does it mean for something to be subjectively true? Now, it seems like maybe it's kind of a funny idea to think that something can be subjectively true, but I think it can. And I think we probably know what we mean when we say that. Let me give a couple of examples of statements that I think are subjectively true. They're not very profound, by the way, but I think they really do. They are subjectively true. Here's one. Let me put it this way. Ice cream is good. Ice cream is good. Is that subjectively true? I think so. Here's another one. Spinach is bad. That's subjectively true? Well, when I say ice cream is good, what am I really saying? We could translate that sentence to mean in what words? I just kind of said it earlier, but it slipped out on me before. When I say ice cream is good, what I'm really meaning is, I like it. Isn't that what I'm saying? When I say spinach is bad, I'm really saying I don't like it. And so you see what that means is, let's suppose we come across to somebody. I'm meeting with somebody else, and it's David down here, right? David, and I've got this the third time now around on your name, so I'm getting David's name pretty good here. So what if I come to David and I say, David, certainly you agree with me when I say ice cream is good, don't you? And let's suppose David, I hope you wouldn't say this, but suppose David would say, no, actually, in my head, the way I say it, ice cream is bad.
It is bad.
Can you believe this? I think he's serious too. So we actually got a pretty example. I'm disappointed in you, David, but it is an example that's going to work for what we want to do here today. Okay. So I'm saying ice cream is good, meaning I like ice cream. David says ice cream is bad, meaning David does not like cream. Let's put those two statements on the board. Ice cream is good. Ice cream is bad. Can they both be true? Weirdly enough, they actually can, because you know what they all mean? Paul likes it. David doesn't like it. Are those statements both true? That's all they mean. Subjective statements can be. And so what we're getting at with this is this. A subjectively true statement is one where the truth depends upon the attitude or the opinion or the belief of the speaking subject. So David's statement is true because it depends upon his attitude or his view of ice cream, and mine is true because it depends upon mine. We could even say this in a different way, and this is a fairly important way to say this. In a subjectively true statement, it's a subject or a person who creates or determines the truth of that statement, right? Well, I say ice cream is good. It's true only because I happen to like it. And I determine the truth of that statement, which of course means then, as we saw a moment ago, conflicting statements can both be true if they're subjectively true. This is kind of an odd thing, but on the other hand, I think we know this already. When we talk about subjectivity, we know that. Okay? The trick is sometimes taking something the subjective and it flips into the category of the objective in a sly way. People don't catch what we're doing there. But if it's a straight subjective statements, it doesn't seem to be any big deal to say conflicting statements can both be true. And that's an important concept to hold on to. But compare that now with objective statements, objectively true statements. Let me give an example of an objectively true statement. I'm not sure how many people we have in the room. Do we have, what, 670 people in the room? Is that what we have here? I'm going to pick a number, 75. I really don't know what the number is. I'm really pretty bad at this, but I'm going to say we have 75 people in this room. Okay, suppose we counted them up and that's what there were. So I walk in the room and I say, there are 75 people in this room. Once, if we have counted them up and we know that, that statement's true, correct? Is it just subjectively true? No, that's objectively true, isn't it? How about this one? The city of Vernon exists. That's true. But that's not just subjectively true, that's objectively true, right? What do we mean by an objectively true statement? Well, it does not depend upon anyone's attitude or opinion. And we could put it this way. Objective truth is there to be recognized or discovered, you see, as compared to the other ones which were there to be determined, which were determined or created by the person making the statement. You see the difference there? These differences, I think, are pretty critical. With objective statements, they're there to be recognized or discovered, not determined or created. That's how it is in subjective statements. And you know what? Objective truth is just a pretty stubborn thing, isn't it? So if somebody walked in the room and said, well, you know what? Chamberlain, you're saying there's 75 people in this room, but you know what my view is? My view is there is 375. That's my view. Now, what am I going to do with that? Well, I could say, well, okay, I guess that's your view. You have a right to hold your view. I could say that, I suppose. Could I ever say, okay, well, you're right too? I really can't say that, can I? You know why? Because there's not 375. They're 75. It's just kind of a stubborn thing. It just sits there as a truth that we recognize and we discover. We don't create it. We don't determine it. So if someone disagrees with an objective truth, it ends up being that they're just simply wrong. There's not too much we can do about that. Now, let's get back to our point here for moral relativism. Remember the definition of moral relativism? It said, it's a view that says, there are no objectively true moral principles which apply to all people consistently. That's saying that the view that says morality is completely dependent upon, is completely relative to the individual person or a situation or a time. Morality is a completely personal, private, subjective matter. Think of those statements about ice cream and about spinach. Moral statements are in that category, not this one over here. Okay? There's a book that was written a fair number of years ago now, called Truth is Stranger Than It Used to Be. Some of you may have heard of that book or seen it by two authors, Middleton and Walsh. They have written a couple books together. Truth is Stranger Than It Used to Be. And they illustrate this very same point by talking about three umpires standing around doing their job. Talking about how they do their job. Anybody in this room ever been an umpire before, a baseball umpire? I'm sure some of you have. Yeah, I've had to do it myself. I don't really care for the job that much, but that's what sometimes you get called upon to do. Well, look at three umpires talking about how they do their job, and this kind of illustrates this point. The first one said this, okay? I call them as I see them. How's that? No problem. Call them as you see them. The second person said, umpire said, no, that's not how I do it. I call them as they are. Okay? So he thinks he's seeing them just as they are, and that's how he's calling them. The third umpire, no way. I don't do it that way at all. They ain't nothing till I call them. See what he's saying here? When that pitcher throws that ball down there to that catcher, it's nothing till I call it. Okay, well, I call it, my call makes it what it is. Okay? And the point he's saying, I don't recognize that pitch as being a ball or a strike on its own. It ain't nothing till I call it. I determine what it's going to be. My call makes it what it is. And the point is that very same thinking, which when applied to morality, gives us moral relativism. That's what moral relativism is really all about right there. It's a view that says, I don't recognize any act as being objectively, intrinsically good or bad, right or wrong, whether it be abortion or premarital sex or honesty or fraud or extramarital sex even. It doesn't matter. None of these matter. These may be wrong for you, but that's fine. Let's respect each other. Let's not call each other wrong, because in reality, neither of us is wrong. We're both right, because remember, the truth of moral statements is dependent upon, determined, created by the individual subject or person. Just like the statement about the ice cream and about the spinach. So you can have your moral attitude, your moral position, your moral code. I can have mine as well, and we can both be right. That's what moral relativism is all about. Of course, the implication of that is that if that's the case, then of course we have no right to impose our moral values on others, do we? That would make no sense, would it? Just as if I came to David and said, David, you're just completely wrong on that ice cream. You've got to change your view on that. You'd say, Chamberlain, lighten up here. You may like it, but you got to lighten up here a little bit. Because he's just as justified in saying, having his view on that. That's how it would be here as well. We have no right to impose our moral values. And the other one is, we've said a couple times, conflicting moral statements could both be right. Now you see, this leads to a little bit of confusion and chaos in our culture though. And maybe some of you have seen this kind of thing. Here's how I've seen it. In our culture, there seems to be a huge number of people who would claim to be moral relativists. That would be where they would fit, however they would identify themselves. They kind of fit there. That all moral values, all moral claims are equally legitimate, correct. And if you take your moral values and you look across the way at somebody else and say, no, those values are wrong, my values are correct, you'll be seen to be arrogant or intolerant. It's much better to say, no, all the moral values and claims are equally legitimate, equally correct. I'm sure you've seen this just as I have. So you deny the existence of objective moral principles or objective right and wrong. That kind of thing. And of course, we don't want to impose our moral values on you, and we don't want you to impose on us. And the idea is that this is tolerant, and this is open. We can all be right on these things. We just have different viewpoints. And we don't want to be those narrow-minded, intolerant bigots who are claiming to be right, and others are wrong on moral issues. There's a very wide spectrum of people in our culture who would take that to take that line of thinking. But on the other hand, here's where I say there's confusion. And because on the other hand, very many of the same people are very willing to roundly condemn the things which they oppose, and in fact demonstrate great moral outrage at those things. Things like intolerance. How about that? Intolerance is bad. You shouldn't be intolerant like that. Or bigotry. Or racism. Or child abuse. Or a violation of the of rights of people. Or a violation of the rights of workers in sweatshops, of women and children, gay people, etc. It goes on and on. Now, what I'm saying here, there's a confusion here, a contradiction here, because when you think about it, you have no right to condemn intolerance or bigotry or child abuse or rape or slavery or gay bashing or child sacrifice or environmental destruction, or there's some other pretty bad ones. How about the practice of killing a woman because she's been raped? That happens in our world sometime, and we always speak out against that. But you have no right to condemn those things as objectively, genuinely wrong if morality is purely subjective and personal and private. The most you can say is that those actions offend my personal moral taste. I don't like them. But others obviously have different moral tastes, and they're equally entitled to call those legitimate and good. I have no right to impose my moral values on them. That's the most you can say if you really take the view that morality is all a personal and private matter. Which has led me to the conclusion that is quite clear that there are very few real, true moral relativists out there. Even though many, many people will claim to be, and many people will practice that quite a ways, because most of us cannot escape the idea that certain some things really are truly right and truly wrong. But let's analyze that, though. Let's analyze it. How do we think of this idea now that we've seen how it works? Let me give you four or five ideas here that I think can help us. The first one is this. Well, just before I say this, I just want to say this about moral relativism. This is the kind of thing where there isn't really any kind of slam dunk argument. This is, I can prove to you it's false and wrong, and here's how. You can't really do that. What you do is you say, what if it were true? What would follow from it being true? Okay, and then that's what happens in all of the things you see on this. And let me just put some of those up there. If it were true, it would mean what we've seen already, that no action could be condemned as genuinely wrong. If moral relativism is completely true, then how could you ever condemn any action as genuinely wrong, no matter what, whether it be intolerance, or rape, or murder, or child abuse, or discrimination, all those things we've been saying about that. Because all these are simply a matter of personal, private, moral taste. As I said a moment ago, the most you could say, if morality is purely subjective and private and relative, is that these things offend my personal moral taste. And others have, I don't like them, but others obviously have different moral tastes, which they're equally entitled to call legitimate and good. That's the most you could say. The problem is here that our actions and reactions to different kinds of things that happen in the world around us betray the fact that we all, as people around in this world, all of us do recognize the difference between good and evil. We know there's a difference, and in fact, it seems to me we recognize it so strongly that we have terms for people who don't seem to. Have you heard the term psychopath? Sociopath. What do we mean by a sociopath, psychopath? A person who doesn't really seem to have any moral categories. That's the term we have for that person. And when we see a person like that, we're quite convinced something is seriously wrong with that person. I remember when this Paul Bernardo incident came to light. This was a number of years ago, but I still remember this. Paul Bernardo and Carl Homolka were a couple of people out in Ontario, a husband and wife, who had been involved in kidnapping young women. And then doing horrendous things with them, ultimately in some cases leading to their dying. And in one case, in a couple of cases, they happened to videotape the whole thing, and that was their undoing. These videotapes were discovered. And when they were then arrested and brought to trial, and they were in the news, you just wouldn't believe. If some of you may remember the public reaction, it was very, very quick and very visceral. And I find it quite instructive, because you'll probably remember the hue and cry. There was outrage and anger expressed against them, and there was also some graffiti sprayed in various places out in Ontario. Well, one piece of graffiti I heard about just said these words: "Burn in hell, Bernardo." Now, I thought about that, and I thought, I know whoever wrote that spoke for a lot of other Canadians who knew about this story, and knew what they had done. I thought, you know, that piece of graffiti, if that represents the views of a lot of people, that tells us a number of things, doesn't it? That tells me, first of all, that deep down there is an innate awareness that good and evil exist, and that this act is truly evil. No matter what you call yourself before that day, if you agree with that statement, that tells you deep down there's an innate awareness good and evil exist, and this was evil. It also tells us there's an innate awareness that justice really should be done, It's pretty clear what that would mean for Bernardo in this case. Here's the third thing it told me. This is a tiny bit off track, but I find it so powerful. It indicated to me, that statement, burn in hell, Bernardo, that deep down there might even be an innate hope that something like hell does exist for people who we think are bad enough that that's where they need to go. And that's interesting in a society that usually brings out hell as a serious objection to Christianity. How could a God of love and justice have something like hell? But when we see what Bernardo did, what do we write on the wall? Burn in hell, Bernardo. And it tells me that deep down there may even be this innate hope. Well, it seems to me that we need to understand that if moral relativism is correct, no act could be condemned the way this person was condemning that act. But let's go to a second one. We may have thought of that first one before, but I wonder if you thought about this one here. If moral relativism is correct, it also means no act could be commended as genuinely good. Think about that. For the very same reason, if objective good and evil are gone, if that's the case, how are you going to ever condemn any act as being genuinely wrong? It's simply that certain acts will appeal to your personal moral taste and others will not. But there's nothing really objective about it. We don't commend people for having certain moral tastes, this or that. We just say they have their moral tastes. So not only would we have trouble condemning an act, but how about commending one as well? Let me go to a third one here, which I'll simply call blue folders. What are we getting at with this thing with the blue folders? This is one that I've always been really interested in, and I found it quite intriguing. And tell me if this strikes a nerve with you. The point I want to make with the blue folders one is that it seems to me that even people who claim to be moral relativists rarely succeed in living that way. They rarely succeed in living it out. Okay, and there's numerous ways you could show this, but there's a story about blue folders that has been circulated for quite a while about a student who wrote an essay in which he argued very eloquently in favor of moral relativism throughout the entire essay from beginning to end. And there's ways, of course, you could do that, and it was actually not a bad essay in terms of its organization, its clarity, its structure, its research, grammar, the argumentation. The whole thing was not too bad, and he handed it in a blue folder. Okay, well, the professor looked at it and said, you know what, I think I'm going to try and make a point to the student. Professor read through the whole thing, got to the very bottom of it, and wrote on the bottom of the essay. Excellent essay. However, I'm sorry, I do not like blue folders. Grade F. Send it back to the student. Well, of course, as you know, you can guess the student stormed back into the professor. And what did he say? That is not fair. That is not right. You cannot do that. If I wrote a good essay, I deserve a good grade. And the professor looked up and said, is this the essay which has argued there are no objective standards such as fairness and justice which apply to all people across the board? And the student said, yes, that's the one. The professor said, well then, I'm sorry, I don't like blue folders. Your grade has to be an F. Well, as the story goes, when the professor made his point, he changed the grade. But see, what was the point? The point was on the student's own ethical system, the one he argued so passionately for in his essay, he really had no legitimate beef, did he? No legitimate complaint, because the professor was merely acting as though there were no objective standards, like justice and fairness, which should be applied consistently, as the student had argued. In other words, he decided to try out the young man's ethical system on the young man himself. But the trouble is, when it came to the student's own essay, what did the student do? He immediately appealed to objective standards, fairness and justice, and in fact, he demanded that the professor recognize and apply those to his own essay. You hear stories like this kind of thing all the time. It ends up being, in my mind, a fairly damning charge, because it shows that moral relativism may even in the end be unlivable, even by those who profess to accept it, to believe it. Because none of us gets by very long without appealing to objective moral standards. I remember Ravi. I used to work with Ravi Zacharias, as some of you know. And he told us a story one day, something that happened to him recently, and I think this is actually in one of his books right now. But he had been out in Oxford University in England, and he gave a lecture. And in the lecture, he talked partly about the foundational requirement for objective moral value, objective moral truth, and he argued against moral relativism. He said when he got done, the student came up to him, and he argued very adamantly with him against objective morality. He said, I'm a moral relativist. And he argued, and Ravi said, he took about 10 minutes. Ravi said, I tried everything. There was no way I could convince this young man that morality was objective, that moral relativism was wrong. And then, I mean, no way that he would accept it. So finally, Ravi said, I just said to him this. Let's just suppose that I brought a little baby up here and put the baby on the table right here in front of us. And I took a machete. I brought it down and I just began cutting that baby in little pieces. Would I have done something really wrong? He says the young man sat there and looked at him, and he said, Rabbi says he played with his toes a little bit. He wasn't sure what to say. Didn't want to say yes, didn't want to say no. And finally ended up saying this, I would not like what you have done, but I would not be able to say that what you had done was really wrong. And I was thinking, yeah, right. I'm sure that's not what he would say if that really happened. What does he think about what happened in Rwanda? That was my first reaction. What happened in Rwanda? They did that in Rwanda, and we apologize in Canada. We apologize for not getting involved and stopping that. The U.S. apologized for not getting involved. What are we apologizing for if nothing really wrong happened there? Okay. The point I took away from there is that the moral relevance at this point, when it really pushed, to maintain that this system of thought in a consistent fashion, is forced to end up making highly implausible statements like the one he made right there. But that's what he would simply have to say. I would not like what you've done, but I would not be able to say that what you have done is wrong. And so you end up pushing to the highly implausible statements. Let me go to number four here. The fourth one is this. This is one that I didn't actually used to have in here, but I have it in here now, which I think is important. And that is this, that appealing to tolerance as the basis or the reason for preferring moral relativism, as is commonly done, by the way, is counterproductive. It's self-refuting. In fact, it backfires. You see what I'm getting at there? Okay? See, what's commonly done is to say, if you're not a moral relativist, you must be intolerant. How intolerant can you get to impose your moral values and to think your moral values are correct and others are incorrect, the opposite are incorrect? So you appeal to tolerance as the basis for moral relativism. I'm saying here up here for point number four that doing that is actually self-refuting. It backfires. Why? Why are we saying that? Because it treats tolerance as a bedrock objective moral principle, one that should not be violated. That's what that does. See what we're saying here? So if you're saying the reason we need to be moral relativists is because it would be intolerant to do otherwise, and we've got to be tolerant, what are you doing there? You're treating tolerance as a bedrock objective moral principle that ought not to be violated. And you've just shown that you yourself are not a moral relativist after all. You thought you were, but you're not. It backfires. But the reason I say this is because this is the most common appeal that's made. This is the most common reason given as to why we ought to be moral relativists. Notice the term ought. Ought is an moral objective term, okay? Why ought we to be? Because it's intolerant to be anything else. I'm saying to do that is self-refuting, in fact, it backfires. It shows that the person has already abandoned moral relativism and is appealing to an objective moral principle, namely tolerance. Let me go to number five, one more here. Just a quick comment to make as we close here, and that is this. That I'm saying that any a genuine injustice means that some objective, real standard of justice has been violated. In other words, if there's any genuine injustice in the world, that's what it means. And I would just say, let's think of the implications of all this. If moral relativism does in fact fail, if it does, and I think it's doomed from the beginning myself, for all these reasons we're talking about here, but if it does fail, you know what that means? It's failing because there really is objective moral truth out there, the kind we recognize that we don't invent, the kind we discover, the kind we cannot avoid or we cannot deny. Then morality is not all a relevant personal private matter. But what that means then, if that's the case, it means that when the scripture proclaims objective moral truth to us, or any other moral code for that matter, it is making sense. It's agreeing with what we deep down already recognize, as Paul says in Romans chapter 2, verse 14, which we read this morning. Even the Gentiles have the law of God written on their hearts. They know good from evil, and that's why they look over at the people of God and see the way you were living, is what Paul was saying, and you're giving God a bad name by the way you're living. But if that's the case, I would just say to us today that we ought to do our young people and our children the profound service of confidently setting before them the existence of real good and evil. And I guess I would say this to you, if we do that, I'd make this prediction, that when we do that, when we teach them there is such a thing as real, objective good and evil, this message will resonate resonate with them because they have their own God-given moral conscience, and they will instinctively agree with that. They will know that, but they need to hear it from people they trust. Parents, grandparents, pastors, teachers, friends they respect, medical practitioners, and all this. And I think it'll help them clear up a lot of confusion in our culture, in a society that has quite a bit of confusion to go around. Any comments or questions from any of you on this? Just a couple comments from any of you, and then we'll take a little break and come back for the next one. But what comes to your mind on this? Yes, right here, sir.
You had a picture there of an empire that was three different empires. The one that very important
was
it.
Mm-hmm.
And then
mm-hmm.
That is called in Scripture.
So okay. So if God's the one doing the calling, sure. Okay, yeah. Yeah, God's making some statements. Yeah, I mean that's ultimately where we want to go from here, ultimately, that God is the origin and the source. And this is what Christians have been saying forever anyway. God is the source of all things, including he's the ultimate moral foundation. Yes, the very back.
Part of hearing, can I get a mic for the question?
Yeah, a microphone? Well, you go ahead and say it, and you mean for the other questions? I will do that. I will try to repeat. Yeah, okay. No problem. Thank you. Yeah. If we even have any others, we can take a break as soon as you're ready. But yes, Pat, yeah.
Is there any sense of objective morality without any sense of accountability?
Well, you know what, actually, people like William Lane Craig, who I'm sure you're aware, people who work on this in a big way, they actually divide those two things. Okay, they say they're both very important, by the way. But they said that what William Lane Craig says is, you can have moral, objective moral value, but then you have to ask, who cares? Why? What does that matter? Unless there's also accountability, sanctions standing behind it. So, and then that's how he does it. I mean, morality could be objective. I guess, like technically, theoretically, you could have objective moral value without any kind of accountability there. I guess you'd have to wonder how did it get there? Okay. But Bill Craig simply says, if you had that and there was no God standing behind it, no sanction, no accountability, well then you could just ignore it anyway. Just forget about it if you want to. Okay. Now that's how he says it. Now, I think that bears some thinking, because the question it raises for me is, if there is no God to whom we're accountable, then what would the foundation be for objective moral value? And that's always been something on my mind. If you take God away, what foundation do you have for it? If you undercut the foundation for it, then how would there be objective moral value? That's always been what I've thought from the beginning. If you take a transcendent creator, a moral creator God away, then we can feel like there's objective moral value, but really, how could there be if there's no foundation for it, no source of it? Okay, so that's where I'd be coming from on that. It's a really interesting question, Pat. There's some more thinking too. Yeah, yes.
This kind of might be on that topic, but one of the things I've kind of come across over is the conversation where with someone who supports the idea of objective morality, but has their own idea of where that actually lands.
Yeah.
And one of the things I hear is, it is morally wrong if it, physically hurts somebody.
Yeah.
But there are many things that are relative, that may be morally relative kind of within that.
Right. Yeah, well, no, I would say what I just said, but I'd also point out that when a person says that, all they've really done there is landed on one particular principle that they think is an ultimate foundational principle, with do no harm. That's all that is. That's a do no harm principle. But the question is, what makes that objective? They're telling us they believe it, and they agree with it. But is that objective? Now, if they believe that's objective, well, then why could there not be other objective moral principles as well? Okay, so I mean and that's a very common way of thinking, by the way, in Canadian culture, and I can see why, because that's often how we build our laws. Many of our laws in our legislatures are built around that do no harm principle. We find actions that we may think are right, we may think are wrong. People differ back and forth, but we don't ask that question in the legislatures that much. We ask, is there going to be harm coming to other people if we do that? Okay, and then if there is, we often tend to make that kind of thing illegal. What kind of harm? How much harm? How bad? And that kind of thing. Okay, but if a person treats it like a moral principle, then they're teaching the do no harm principle. They're regarding that as an objective moral principle, and the question then is going to be, on what basis is it objective? Like, you think it's objective, it seems to be something you agree with, but the fact that I agree with it doesn't make it objective. Okay? If it's there, and I recognize it's there, that means it's objective, but if that's the case, it must have been there before I ever got there. Okay? And then that's why I say if you take God out of the picture, well then what basis, what foundation would you have for even principles like that? Which, and we'd all agree with that one, by the way. I think we pretty much agree with that principle. Question is what would make it objective? Good comment. Yeah. We're over here, yes. Okay.
You can say you're tolerant, but that's not sufficient.
You know what? I'm going to ask you to hang on to that until after the break. How's that?
Okay.
Because that's exactly where we're going to go. And this is a former colleague of mine. He thinks he can get away with that kind of stuff. Okay? Jumping ahead to the next section before we're actually there. Okay? You got to hang on, my friend. Okay? But we will get there. And actually, you need to keep that question in mind because that's about as foundational a question as we're going to get to in the next part. Are you okay with that for an answer for now? That's good. Okay. One more question. If anybody has one, we'll take a little break here and we'll come right back. One more right here. Yes, ma'am.
Okay, if you move off the foundations, then
yeah.
Scripture tells us that every man does what's right in his own eye.
Right.
In light of that, how would you comment on the difference between mercy killing and honor killing?
Yeah. I mean that. See, you're using the scriptural statement there from the book of Judges, which comes up numerous times, to describe the situation there. Okay, people doing just what's right in their own eyes. And I mean, if you take away any kind of objective moral standard, no matter where people think they get this from, okay, and the people do believe in an objective moral standard without believing in God. That atheist professor I debated. He didn't think there was any God, but he did believe there was objective morality. Okay, so but if you took that away, then you really are left with simply deciding, well, what do I want to do? What do I prefer? What do you prefer? What do you prefer? And somehow can we make this work among ourselves? Difference between honor killing and mercy killing? Well, I mean, of course, we do know the difference between those two. One is in a kind of a what I would call a really perverted way of thinking, this is what I need to do to maintain honor in my family, because they've dishonored the family, so we can't tolerate that. Okay, so we take matters into our own hands, and we let people know that will not be tolerated. You'll pay the ultimate price for that. Mercy killing is usually taken out. It's usually applied when we have someone who's suffering, and in most cases we're going to die sometime soon, and so we take that into our hands. Okay, and really, when you think of it, these are different. I mean, one's legal in our country, and one's illegal. Honor killing is illegal. Mercy killing is legal. You could imagine a society in which that was flipped around. I mean, societies couldn't make laws. If you really, truly get rid of anything objective, then you pretty much can make any law you feel like making in a culture, in a country. So, I mean, those are very different things that are going on. One's legal, one's not. But in a culture, in a country that gets together, and if they simply ignore any kind of objectivity, well, then really it's just a matter of taking a vote and deciding what they want to do. But you need to realize if that's the case, if we've lost any sense of objectivity, then morality has been reduced to a question of power. Who's got the most votes? It might really does become right. And it really means that the people we're locking up and putting in jail today, if they ever could get more of them than there are of us, they could flip it around and they could make laws to put us in jail, and they'd be just as right as we are now to put them in jail. Because there's nothing objective about it anyway. It'd be just a matter of who prefers what and who's got the most votes. If morality really is reduced to power. That's the other thing that makes the issue of objective morality so foundationally important. If objectivity is completely undermined, then ultimately you will end up with nothing other than a might makes right. Morality becomes a question of power. Who has the most votes? And they really are equally justified in doing whatever they decide to do. Because there's nothing objective about it anyway. So I think I've answered more than you're asking there, but it's kind of an intriguing question. I've never had anybody put those two together in a question for me before.